see beyond the fact that Nauts used to be our slaves. As far as he was concerned, there'd never be much good for anything else. The dissident group was the one thing that kept me focused when I was at Chivers. It was my reason for doing well, for succeeding. Our group kept me sane. It was a shame my sister didn't have something similar to believe in. I used to comfort myself with the belief that it was only certain individuals and their peculiar notions that spoilt things for the rest of us. But how many individuals does it take before it's not the individuals who are prejudiced, but society itself? And it wasn't even that most crosses were prejudiced against Nauts. I still didn't believe that. But everyone seemed to be too afraid to stand up in public and say, "This is wrong." And by everyone, I meant me included. No one wanted to raise their head above the parapet. At least our group knew that the way things were was wrong. At least we were trying to do something about it, albeit from behind the scenes. We moved quietly but irrevocably, like a relentless army of tiny termites eating away at the rotten fabric of a house. And we would succeed. Each of us believed that, for the simple reason that we had to. A few months after joining our group, I thought long and hard about asking Minnie to join us, but in the end, I decided against it. Minnie's only got one more year at school, and judging from the twice I've spoken to her, she's finding being at home difficult, to say the least. She's determined to go to a university as far away from our home as she can get, but Mother cries or throws a tantrum or both if she even so much as mentions it. I'm glad I got out before her. Selfish, but true. According to Minnie, Mother's still drinking. I'm not. Even when some of the girls sneak the odd bottle or two into the dorm at night, I don't touch the stuff. I don't trust myself. It's very easy to hide away in a wine bottle, but very hard to come out again. Besides, that's part of my past, too. I'm designing my future. A future without Callum. I've decided to be a lawyer, but I'm only going to work on those cases that I believe in. I'm going to be another Kalani Adams. I'm going to stand up and speak out, and I'll be so famous and popular that no one will be able to touch me. Not the government, not the PEC, no one. It's great to finally have some direction to my life. I admit that I think about Callum, often, but I've stopped brooding and I've stopped yearning for the impossible. Maybe in another lifetime, or in a parallel universe somewhere, Callum and I could be together the way we should be. But not here, not now. And that's okay too. He's moved on with his life, and now so have I. I wonder if he ever thinks of me. I doubt it. But just occasionally when I'm doing my homework, or washing my hair, or cutting my toenails, I pause for a second or two and wonder. But only for a second. Or two.
Chapter 90. My dad said something once about the Liberation Militia. He said that once they had you, they never let you go. I learned exactly what he meant over the next couple of years. I started off as little more than a T-boy, but I was eager and keen. I soon worked my way up the ranks. I moved on from T-boy to grunt, following the orders of anyone and everyone in my cell of 6 men and 3 women. From grunt, I moved on to private, and on up the ranks, until I earned the rank of sergeant and joined a new cell. Sergeant at 19, I was proud of that. And whilst I was working my way up the LM ranks, I took the time to take care of some personal business. Namely, Dion Fernandez, Lola Jordan and Joanne Longshadow. The ones at Heathcroft who'd beaten up Seffi for sitting with me, for being with me, for not knowing her place, which was kilometres above mine. With the contacts and resources now at my disposal, it wasn't difficult to find out where they lived. I made it my business to find out all about them, their home lives, their family circumstances, their likes and dislikes, everything. If there's one thing that being in the LM taught me, it was that everyone had a weakness. You just had to know where and how to look for it. I dealt with each of them in turn, Lola first, then Joanne, Dion last, but by no means least. I took particular trouble to make sure that Dion suffered, just as she'd made Seffi suffer. They say that revenge is a dish best served cold, and they're right. I served it icy cold. And I lost more of myself as I did so. But that was okay, because the Callum Ryan McGregor who loved to sit on the beach and watch the sun go down didn't exist anymore. He'd been taken, and I'd been left in his place. A poor trade, but an inevitable one. In the new cell, there were four of us altogether: Pete, Morgan, Layla, and me. Pete was in charge. We called him the quiet one. He didn't say much, but he smiled a lot. I was careful to watch my back around him. He was deadly with a knife, and had at least four that I knew about always stashed on him somewhere. Morgan was 20 and the joker of the pack. He was our computer expert, and the best driver in any LM cell for kilometres around. Layla was my age and knew everything there was to know about breaking into buildings and blowing stuff up. She'd been my call. One evening, just a couple of months after my 18th birthday, I'd been sitting, sipping a coffee outside a cafe in the city and surreptitiously timing the guard's movements in the glass-fronted office block opposite, when I first spotted her. It was one of those cafes which likes to pretend it's très chic by serving croissants at night and coffee that's all foam and no flavour, or liquid for that matter. The evening was quite chilly, so apart from me, there were only three other men huddled at another table about 2 metres away from me. Layla came over to me first.
"Spare some change for a coffee?"
I looked at her and shook my head. She moved on to the only other occupied table outside the cafe.
"Spare some change, please."
"Here's £5," one of the morons at the table waved it under her nose. "What will you do for it?" I turned to watch, interested to see what she'd do next. "Well," the man winked at his friends and continued to wave the money under Layla's nose. I could tell from her tense stance that she was furiously angry, but the guy who was showing off to his mates was too thick-skinned to realise it. Or maybe he just didn't care. Layla lurched forward to try and snatch the money from the moron's hand, but he snatched it back.
"Come on, you tart. You can do better than that."
"What did you call me?"
Layla asked softly. I moved my coffee to the other side of my table.
"If the shoe fits," the moron laughed and his friends joined in. "Stand up and I'll show you what I'll do for that fiver," Layla said silkily.
And like a jackass, the man stood up. Seconds later, he was doubled over after Layla's foot made painful contact with his goodies.
"You were right. The shoe does fit,"
Layla hissed at him, snatching the £5 out of his unresisting fingers. Moron number one collapsed to the floor, coughing his guts out. Morons two and three should have remained seated, but they decided to go for it. Big mistake. It took less than 15 seconds for Layla to sort out those two. By the time she'd finished, they were all rolling on the ground like human skittles. I waved to one of the waiters inside the cafe, who was watching the proceedings with horror. He edged out, giving Layla a wide berth. "My bill, please," I told him. I turned to Layla. "Would you like to have dinner with me?" Layla spun around, belligerence all over her face.
"Are you talking to me?"
"Yes. Would you like a dinner? Somewhere away from here, though. The police will be here in about 5 minutes. She looked me up and down, and more than once, before she answered,
"Yeah. Okay, then."
I glanced into the cafe, but my waiter was taking his time. So, guessing at the price, then doubling it, I put my money down on the table. We strolled off down the road towards a good meat restaurant I knew. I'd been poor for too long to be a vegetarian, and as we walked along, Layla never said a word. When we got to the restaurant, she sat down on her chair, poised to leap straight onto her feet if the situation demanded it. "Two menus, please," I said to the waitress. "I'm Callum," I told my new companion, holding out my hand. "Layla," she replied, digging her hands deeper into her pockets. And that was the beginning of our friendship. It had taken me a while to get to know her, but it was well worth the effort. She and I had a similar sense of humour, which always helps. I was the one who recommended that she be taken under our wing. She'd been on her own for a long time before she joined our cell, so she was ridiculously grateful at belonging to the LM, so grateful that she suggested becoming my lover. It was a couple of months later when we were held up in one of our safe houses, waiting for Pete and Morgan to return from a reconnaissance trip. "Thanks for the offer," I told her, "and I'm very, very flattered, but I've only got room for one thing in my life now, and that's my work. You sure? She asked. I nodded. To my surprise, Layla put her hands on my shoulders and kissed me. It was nice, too. But that's all it was.
You sure you won't change your mind?
I'm sure, I smiled.
Well, the offer's always open, she shrugged.
I'll remember that. And we'd both carried on cleaning our field guns. I didn't want to get involved. In fact, I didn't want any distractions, no matter how lovely they were, and Layla was lovely. She was as tall as me and super fit, with dark brown, short, cropped hair, cat-green eyes and a ready smile, in spite of all the crap that had happened to her. Of course, Morgan and Pete couldn't believe the fact that I'd turned her down. I heard the two of them discussing whether or not I batted for the other side. That made me laugh wryly. But I left them to wonder. Sometimes I felt lonely enough to take Layla up on her offer, but I never did. The last thing any of us needed were lovers' quarrels taking our minds off of what we were meant to be doing. So in a short space of time, I made quite a name for myself. I was known as the crazy one. The first one into danger and the last one out. Everyone in my cell was convinced I had nerves of steel. So much so that Pete had to take me to one side and tell me to take it a bit easier or I'd wind up dead. No one realised that that was the whole point. By the time I was 19, I'd gained my stripes and lost my soul. But a soul was unnecessary in my line of work. To make it as a grunt, I had to beat up a dagger. I ambushed one on his way home from work and knocked 7 bells out of him. To prove myself as a private, I had to take on 3 of them. But for that, I was allowed to be armed. I had a knife and I'd been taught how to use it. I won that fight as well. And one of the daggers died later from his wounds. I waited for days to feel something, anything, but I never did. Confirmation, if I needed any, that I was dead inside. And to become a sergeant, well, it doesn't make any sense to dwell on it. I did what I had to do. I did the only thing I could do. I became one of the youngest sergeants in the whole of the Liberation Militia. Second in command of our well-respected cell. One of the most respected. And one of the most wanted. I missed my mum. I sent money to her whenever I could, but I never made any attempt to see her. It would have been too dangerous for both of us. And I never posted the money from the same place twice either. In my line of work, there was no such thing as being too careful. Poor mum. One way or another, she'd lost us all. Through no fault of her own. I never once saw my brother. I heard he was in charge of a cell further north. We never had any contact with each other. I was told not to expect any favours because I was Jude McGregor's brother and Ryan McGregor's son, and I didn't. I didn't expect anything. I didn't want anything. I didn't ask for anything, except complete loyalty from those in my cell, and absolute obedience the couple of times I had to take charge. And I got it too. The police didn't know my identity, my real name. They didn't even know what I looked like. I was careful that way. They just had the code name of our cell, Stiletto, like the very sharp, very deadly dagger. Isn't that ironic? My cell was never given anything too onerous to do, or too dangerous for that matter. We were more of an acquisition cell than otherwise. Money, explosives, guns, you name it, we did what we had to do to get it. I was on my way up and nothing was going to get in my way. Nothing. Our cause was just. Our aim was true. A couple of months after my 19th birthday, Pete received a direct order from LM Command. They were sending a lieutenant to assess his cell's efficiency. Efficiency, my left buttock, Pete fumed. There's nothing wrong with my cell's efficiency. The rest of us could see the strop the message had put Pete in from over 5 kilometres away and wisely kept our distance for the rest of the day. There was no word as to when we could expect this lieutenant, and Pete was determined he or she wouldn't be able to fool any of our work or procedures. He made Layla go through our inventory with a fine tooth comb to make sure that everything was accounted for. Pete went through our accounts himself, whilst Morgan and I grumbled like hell about having to clean our main headquarters in the tunnel complex beneath Celebration Park from top to bottom. We were holed up in the old access tunnels, which were no longer used by anyone but the rats. We received reasonably fresh air from the ventilation grills still scattered throughout the park, but nothing we did got rid of the permanent sewer stench. To be honest, after a couple of weeks in the tunnels, I didn't even notice the smell anymore. We weren't going to be in the tunnels for longer than a month or two, so there was no point in bellyaching about it. We all just got on with it. Morgan and I made sure each tunnel was secure, and our warning devices on the grills were in place and working. At last, when Pete was reasonably satisfied, we all sat down for our dinner, a takeaway meal of burger and chips. "Why isn't there anyone outside guarding the main entrance?" I recognised that voice at once. I leapt up, shocked. "What the hell are you doing here? Unless you're in charge here, I'd sit down and shut up if I were you," came the reply. "I'm in charge." Pete stood up slowly. "You should have been expecting me. I'm your new lieutenant," said my brother Jude. "And I asked you a question. Why is no one outside guarding the main entrance?" I sat down slowly, never taking my eyes off my brother. He turned and looked at me, his eyes burning into mine. And I knew, right then and there, that he still didn't quite trust me, and that everyone in our cell was in danger because of it.
Chapter 91. It was time to go back home. I'd finished my end-of-year exams, and the summer holidays had already started, and I didn't have to wait for the results to know that I'd passed all my subjects. So, as Mother had tersely pointed out, there was no reason for me not to go home. Except that I really didn't want to go back. Over 2.5 years away from home, and to be honest, I had no desire whatsoever to return. I dragged my feet for 2 weeks, but August had started and Mother wasn't taking no for an answer. I'd run out of excuses. Mother and Minnie had been up to see me a few times, sometimes together, a few times apart, but somehow I'd always managed to avoid reciprocating. There was always something stopping me. A holiday with this friend, a long visit to that friend. The excuses had been trotted out one after another. Backpacking, camping, overseas expeditions, you name it, I went on them. Anything to keep me away from home, and I'd got away with it. But not this time. Mother was putting her foot down and insisting, so I had no choice. If I'd had my way, I'd have been 70, not 17 going on 18 when I returned home. I hated that place. So many bad memories. Too many. Carl was sent to pick me up at Chivers. On the long drive home, we barely exchanged a word once the platitudes were over. He was fine, everyone in his family was fine, I was fine, school was fine, end of conversation. It was a long drive home. Getting home was a bit of an anticlimax too. Minnie was spending the week with one of her friends, and Mother was out on one of her rare visits to her Aunt Paulina and had left a message on our answering machine saying that her car had broken down on the motorway, so she'd be late getting home. To be honest, not meeting up with Mother immediately was a bit of relief. I still hadn't worked out how I was going to handle her. Should I be all sunshine and flowers and smile and take nothing seriously? Or should I be morose and somber and take everything she said too seriously? Either way, there was no way I was going to stay put for more than a few days. I'd lined up a summer job with a law practice near to Chivers School, and I had 1 week before I was due to start. 1 week. The new term didn't start until October, and Mother was expecting me to stay for the rest of the summer break. Some hope. "Welcome home, Miss Seffy." Sarah hugged me as she emerged from the study. I hugged her back. "It's good to see you, Sarah," I smiled. Sarah looked around quickly. "A certain someone found out that you were due home today, and he left a message for you." She whipped out a folded brown envelope from her pocket and stuffed it into my hand. Without another word, Sarah disappeared back into the study. No need to ask who it was from. I recognised the handwriting on the envelope at once. My heart bounced about at the mere sight of it. What did he want after all this time? I should just put the letter in the bin. Yeah, right. In another lifetime, maybe. I tore open the carefully sealed letter and began to read. "Dear Seffy, I know it's been a long time since we last met, and you probably don't even remember me anymore. But if you do, please, could we meet tonight around 9 o'clock at our special place? It's very important. but I'll understand if you can't make it. Two, almost 3 years is a long time. A lifetime. See. Why did he want to see me? Why was it important? All the feelings I thought I'd bundled up and thrown away years ago suddenly came rushing through me again. Did I really want to see him again? It didn't take much intuition to realize that Callum was the one person who could upset my carefully constructed plans for what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. Look at this. One letter, and I was already confused and uncertain about what I should do next. No, I wouldn't do it. Callum had his life now, and I had mine, and they were worlds apart. But I hadn't seen him in such a long time. And what harm could a short 10-minute meeting do? I was a big girl now, not a child anymore. I'd go and say hello, and we'd pass the time by catching up with each other's lives, and then we'd part on better terms than happened years ago. Where was the harm in that? Don't go, Seffy. Where's the harm in that? Don't go. Where's the harm? Don't.
Chapter 92. Is everyone clear about what they're supposed to do? Jude asked. Nods and grunts and a low-pitched grumbled, yeah, how many more times? She might not even come, I warned. If she got your message, she'll come, Jude announced. He gave me an assessing look. What about you, little brother? You up for this? Why wouldn't I be? I asked, pulling on my black leather jacket. We need to know we can count on you, on your loyalty, said Jude. Everyone stopped what they were doing. The room grew very still. I regarded my brother, not attempting to disguise my hostility. Meaning? Jude looked at me, but he didn't say anything. I looked around. Which one of you doubts my loyalty, then? Silence. I'm glad to hear it, I said. You let us down, and I'm going to forget you're my brother. Understand, said Jude. I didn't deign to answer. My brother could go rivet himself. This is going to make us famous, said Morgan, as he and Pete slapped hands in gleeful anticipation. And rich, Jude grinned. Just think about all that lovely money we're going to be able to add to the Liberation Militia's coffers. Come to Papa, Morgan laughed, rubbing his hands together. And if this comes off, Jude said to Pete, you'll be able to write your own ticket. You'll be able to set up your own LM division anywhere in the country. Sounds good to me, Pete smiled. It was the first smile he directed at my brother. The promise of a bigger and better army to lead had sweetened him up no end, and all his resentment about being usurped by Jude seemed to have melted away. Well, let's not count our chickens, I said brusquely. Ever the voice of doom, eh? Jude smiled. If you do your part, nothing'll go wrong. Nothing.
Chapter 93. I took off my sandals and headed for the moonlit water. I couldn't remember when I'd felt more at peace with myself. I'd finally got a lot of things straight in my head. Like Dad. For him, his political career came first, last, and every number in between. Dad was never going to have any time for me and my sister and my mother. The only reason we'd been around at all was because a stable family was a necessary, compulsory adjunct for a politician. And that was okay. That was the life Dad had chosen for himself, and my days of pining about it were over. I shifted my heels, then toes, to stop my feet from sinking into the wet sand. I kicked up the water, lapping over my feet and ankles, watching it fly up and out in an arc of silvery droplets. Laughing, I did it again and again, alternating kicking feet, delighting in my childish game. And then I thought of Mother, and the game stopped. Mother. I'd always be a disappointment to her. That was never going to change. I was simply not enough. Not ladylike enough, not smart enough, not pretty enough. Not enough. And that was okay too. Her life was her major disappointment, her mistakes carved into every premature line in her face. But I wasn't going to let her use my life as her second chance. I had planned. In September, I'd be 18 years old, and I had my whole life and the whole world in front of me. A world full of choices and decisions and opportunities, and they were all mine for the taking. And as for Callum and me, well, I didn't want the moon. I was prepared to settle for friendship between us. It would never be the way it was years ago, and it'd never be the way I wanted it to be. But maybe we could find something new to take the place of what we had before. Maybe. I glanced at my watch, wondering where Callum had got to. I turned, almost as if thinking about Callum would conjure him up. I gasped. Callum was standing right behind me, his appearance so sudden that he might have been a ghost, able to appear and disappear at will. And he looked so different. He'd shot up like a beanstalk. He was lean now, rather than skinny. He'd definitely sprouted muscles, and his dark cords and leather jacket made him look mysterious somehow. His hair was longer too, almost shoulder length. It suited him. Everything about him seemed different. Callum the boy had disappeared, and in his place... I smiled, chiding myself. It was as if I'd expected time to stand still for him. I'm glad it hadn't, though. Had I changed as much? I guess I must have. Good sneaking, I congratulated him with a wry smile. Slipping on my sandals, I stepped forward, my arms outstretched for a hug. I expected a similar jovial reply and greeting, but he didn't even smile. And even in this light, I could tell something was wrong. My arms dropped to my sides. Callum? Callum stepped forward and kissed me, a brief, icy-cold kiss on the lips. He stepped away from me, his eyes filled with regret. And then I saw them behind him. Four of them. Four noughts, walking towards us, towards me. A quick glance at Callum. Shock on my face. Confirmation, resignation on his. And I didn't wait to see any more. I turned and ran. Ran along the shore, away from him, away from Callum, ran for my life. I could hear them yelling behind me. Not the words. I didn't try to decipher the words. Run, Seffi! Don't stop! No sounds of footsteps on the sand, just shouts and curses and laboured breathing. No lights to guide my way. Even the moonlight was fading as a cloud hid the moon's face from me. Salty, damp air caught in the back of my throat. Run! 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 Don't look back. They'll catch you if you do. Don't look. And most of all, don't think. Don't think about him. Don't think about anything. Just run! And then I realized my mistake. I was kilometers from anywhere, and I was running away from the cliff steps, not towards them. And I had four noughts after me. Five. Head for the sea! I turned on my heels and sprinted towards the darkness. Before my third step, I was grabbed by the waist and swung around. I kicked back with my heels and swung my head back at the same time. Oof! He dropped me, and I hit the ground, running. Bloody dagger, bitch! I ran straight into a crucifying punch to my stomach that had me instantly doubled over and retching onto the sand. That's for my sister, a voice above me said. At least I think it did. My stomach was on fire, and all I wanted to do was curl up in a ball. Arms clamped around my waist from behind and lifted me up, tightening until I could hardly breathe. The man who held me shook me hard, then banged me down onto my feet. Without giving me a chance to catch my scattered breath, he immediately began to drag me backwards, his hands under my arms. My bare heels dragged over sharp rocks and stones. I raised my arms to try and slide out of the man's grasp, but he was ready for that one. My arms slid down his, but he grabbed my hands before I could free myself, and now I was being pulled backwards by my hands. My legs and back were being punctured by the rocks and stones. The man holding me jumped up onto a boulder, almost pulling my arms out of their sockets as he dragged me after him. My whole body was pain now. Closing my eyes, I whimpered. Don't pass out. Open your eyes. I opened my eyes to see the moon almost directly above me, and just for one split second, my body no longer hurt. Then a dark bag was shoved over my head, and the world turned to blackest ink.
Chapter 94. We did it! Jude was jubilant. We ruddy did it! Pete and Morgan danced an impromptu jig around each other. Yes, we had done it. We had Persephone Hadley, Kamal Hadley's daughter. And she wouldn't see the light of day again if Kamal didn't agree to our demands. As simple as that. We'd bundled the unconscious Seffi into the boot of our car, and now we had her stashed away where no one would ever find her. Or us. We were in the middle of nowhere, the perfect location. Weren't we clever? I'm proud of you, little brother. Jude slapped me on the back. I spun, grabbed his jacket and shoved him against the wall all in one movement. Don't you ever doubt my loyalty again. Do you understand me? I hissed, my face only centimetres away from Jude's. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Morgan step forward, only to be pulled back by Pete. I didn't care. I'd take on all of them to get to Jude if I had to. My brother and I watched each other for silent moments. Do you understand? I repeated, slamming him against the wall again. I understand, Jude said. I released him at once. We regarded each other. So, the mouse can roar, can he? Jude smiled. I took a step forward, my fists clenched. Peace, brother, peace. Jude held up his hands, laughing at the expression on my face. I clenched my fists even harder at that. Never before had I wanted to hurt him as much as I did now. I wanted to destroy him. Hatred churned inside me, feeding on itself and growing bigger. You did a good job, Jude told me softly. I turned away from the approbation on his face. Morgan, Pete and even Layla had the same look of praise and admiration all over their stupid faces too. What's our next move? Pete asked Jude, all past resentments forgotten. We deliver the ransom note with proof we have her to the girl's father, Jude replied. What kind of proof? I asked more sharply than I intended. What would you suggest, little brother? Another test. I'll sort that out. I'll cut off some of her hair and film her holding today's paper. Maybe we need something more convincing than just her hair, Jude suggested. Another test. What did you have in mind? You tell me, little brother. I made my mind go blank. It wasn't Seffi in there. It was just some cross female who we needed to get what we wanted. It wasn't Seffi. Something of hers that's bloodstained might be more effective, I suggested. Good idea, Jude nodded. What would you suggest? Leave it to me. I'll sort that out too. I took the camcorder down from the shelf and put a fresh disc inside it. A strange silence filled the room. I looked up to find all eyes upon me. Yes, I said through gritted teeth. Everyone made a big display of going about their business at that. I took some scissors and a sharp knife out of the drawer, and, tucking today's paper under my arm, I headed for Seffi's prison cell. I walked along the short corridor of our three-room brick cabin. It wasn't much. The kitchen was disgusting, with years of neglected grease and grime over practically every surface. Jude had suggested that someone clean it, looking pointedly at Layla as he said so. In response, she'd let her fingers do the talking. Apart from the kitchen, there was the living room, full of rolled-up sleeping bags, a small oak table and all the equipment we might need in a hurry. Tins of food, weapons, few explosives, small TV, a radio, that sort of thing. The third room had been turned into a cell, not by us. That was just what this place was used for, a place to hold a prisoner or two and their wardens. Ever since the information had filtered down over 2 weeks ago now that Seffi could be on her way home, Jude and Pete had been plotting and planning for this moment. They got permission from the General himself to go ahead, and the General's second-in-command was due to come and see us the day after it happened. So much scheming and calculating to bring us to this moment. We were pretty safe in this cabin. It was known to a select few on a need-to-know basis only. But we weren't going to take any chances. Two of us would be on guard at all times, one out front and one out back. And as the cabin was in a clearing in some woods, anyone coming towards us would find themselves without cover of any kind before they reached us. Everything was taken care of. And we'd succeeded. We had Seffi. No, not Seffi. Just a cross girl who deserved everything she got. Who'd get us everything we needed. I paused outside the cell door. I could do this. I had to do this. Be what you have to be, Callum, not what you are. I repeated that phrase over and over in my head, the way I used to do when I first joined the LM. The way I had to whenever there was something distasteful that needed to be done. Be what you have to be, Callum, not what you are. I unlocked the cell door and went inside.
Chapter 95. At the sound of the door being unlocked, I struggled to sit up. My bed was just a wire spring base with a mattress as thin as a carrier bag. I groaned and winced, wrapping my arms around my painful stomach. It ached like nothing I'd ever felt before. My whole body hurt from my heels to my nape. Had they tried to strangle me? My throat certainly hurt, as if someone had done exactly that. The door opened. I moved my hands away from my abdomen. I wasn't going to show any of my captors how badly hurt I was. Callum. The sight of him standing in the doorway was like an arrow whizzing straight through my body. He wasn't the Callum I'd grown up with, and I'd been an idiot to think he would be. It had all been a trick, a trap, and like the biggest fool in the universe, I'd fallen for it. He took a step towards me. Afraid, I drew back. For a briefest of seconds, I thought he flinched, but I was just imagining things. He couldn't care less how I thought of him. He came over to me. I drew back even further. What was he going to do? It was only when he was leaning over me that I noticed the scissors in his hands. I trembled, terrified, then clamped my teeth together hard in an effort to stop myself from shaking. Whatever happens, don't cry. Don't beg. As Callum's hands touched my hair, I froze. I looked up at him without even blinking. I couldn't even wonder what he was doing. My mind was shutting down. Then I heard the clip of the scissors and Callum moved away. Only then did I look away, my body slumping with such relief that I felt sick with it. My hand flew to my head. He'd cut off some of my hair. That was all. Just some of my hair.
"I want you to hold this newspaper,"
Callum told me. His voice was different. Deeper. Gruffer. And I'd missed it. I'd missed a lot of things. "Why?" I asked.
"I need to film you holding today's newspaper."
That wasn't what I was asking. "I'm not going to help you." I folded my arms across my chest. No way was I going to hold that paper or do anything else he told me to do. Two other noughts appeared behind Callum in the doorway. With a start, I saw that one of them was a woman, not the man I thought her on the beach. "Hold that paper, or we'll break your arms and arrange them in such a way that you'll have no choice," the man behind Callum hissed at me. Callum turned to look at him. I'd seen him somewhere before. If I could just figure out...
"I don't need you standing over me supervising,"
Callum fumed.
"Not supervising, just observing, little brother."
And only then did I recognise him. Jude, Callum's brother.
"Nothing like keeping kidnapping in the family, is there?"
I told them.
"Hold the newspaper, Seffi."
Callum held it out for me. Reluctantly, I took it. Callum lifted up his camcorder, only to lower it again immediately.
"Look, I don't need an audience," Callum told the spectators.
"I've come to see the daughter of the famous Kamal Hadley," the woman replied. "Let's see the silver spoon, then."
I regarded her, trying not to cringe at the venom in her voice. Without knowing a single thing about me, she hated my guts. I was a cross, and that was all she wanted or needed to know.
"I bet you've never had more to worry about in your life than chipping the odd fingernail," the woman hissed at me.
"Layla, go and do your job. Guard the front," Jude told her.
Casting one last poisonous look at me, Layla did as directed. I'd have to be careful of that one. She wouldn't spit on me if I was on fire. None of them would.
"I want you to read out that message for your father," Callum told me, handing me a piece of paper with my lines on it.
He held up the camcorder to watch the preview screen. I glanced down at the sheet. If he thought I was going to say any of this, then he was crazy. I scrunched it up and threw it across the room.
"Dad, don't give them a penny!" I shouted.
Callum lowered the camcorder, but before I could say a word,
Jude flew across the room, grabbed hold of both my jacket lapels with just one hand and slapped my face before shaking me viciously. You're not in control here. We are. And you will do as you're told or you won't leave this place alive. Do you understand? I rubbed my cheek, fighting to hold back the tears. You will do exactly as you are told, or I will make this place your hell on earth. None of us are going to take any of your crap, Jude said softly. He let go of me so suddenly I fell backwards onto the bed, hitting my head against the brick wall behind me. Jude straightened up and headed out of the room, pausing briefly as he reached Callum.
Make sure she does as she's told, he said, making sure I could hear.
Moments later, he was gone. I wondered about making a break for it, but Callum was between me and the door. Plus, from the sound of it, the front door was guarded by that girl Layla, and Jude wouldn't hesitate to take me down if he reckoned it was required. I had to bide my time. If only my head would stop ringing so that I could think straight. If only my stomach would stop hurting so I could at least sit up without pain. If only... I had to get him talking. I had to get him to remember me, remember us as we used to be. I had to get him to think of me again as a fellow human being with a name and thoughts and feelings, instead of the nothing I obviously was to him now. Callum, I understand why you feel you have to do this, I began. I really do, but this isn't the way. Nothing, but I wasn't going to give up. Callum, listen to me. At Chivers, I became involved in protests and debates and sit-ins. If you try to change the world using violence, you'll just swap one form of injustice for another. This isn't right. There are other ways.
Like what? Like being educated to fight the system from within, Callum challenged. I tried that, remember?
I know, but if you just give it another try, I could help you.
I don't want to hear it, and I don't want your ruddy help. I'm sick of your charity and your handouts, he interrupted. You're just like all the others. You think we Norse can't do a damned thing unless you crosses are there to help or supervise.
And his body shook with such rage that I had to force myself to continue. Don't hate me for wanting to change the way things are. I believe in you, Callum. You can change the world. I know you can, but not like this, I said. I'm not trying to be magnanimous or patronizing. I genuinely want to help, but...
Enough! Hold up the newspaper and read the words on this, Callum ordered, handing me the now smoothed-out sheet of paper again.
I looked up at Callum.
Read it,
he said, his attention on the camcorder and nothing else.
Callum, please, read it.
After a moment's pause, I began to read.
Chapter 96. Dad, I've been ordered to read what's on this sheet. I've been kidnapped, and the kidnappers say you'll never see me again unless you do exactly as instructed. Your instructions will be in the envelope, along with this video disc. You have 24 hours to follow their instructions to the letter. If you don't, I'll be... killed. If you go to the police or tell anyone, I'll be killed. The kidnappers will know every move you make and every person you talk to. If you ever want to see me alive again, please do as they say. Seffi looked up from her sheet of paper, tears trickling down her cheeks. I moved my hand up to indicate that she should lift up the newspaper. She did so at once. I zoomed into the paper so there could be no doubt about the date. Then I moved to zoom into Seffi's face. She quickly wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. She wasn't looking at the camcorder. She was looking at me. I switched off her camcorder. That ought to do it. I took the newspaper from Seffi's unresisting hand. I looked her up and down critically. What are you wearing?
Pardon?
You heard me. Puzzled, Seffi said.
Trousers, a jacket, a jumper.
Tell me everything you're wearing, I ordered. Silence. I can always find out for myself, I threatened. Sandals, jeans, knickers, watch, bra, t-shirt, jumper, necklace, jacket, earrings. Satisfied? Take off your t-shirt. No way. Take off your t-shirt or I'll do it for you. Seffi gave me a long, hard, fearful look. She obviously decided I was serious, which I was, because she started to take off her jacket. Are you going to kill me, Callum? That'd be ridiculous. I closed my eyes and turned away so Seffi couldn't see my face. Why couldn't she just shut up? Why did it have to be her? I thought I could do this. I never realised just how much you and your family hate us, Seffi whispered. Jude looked at me like he wanted to kill me just now. Why does he hate me so much? Is it me personally or just what I am? I didn't answer. I squatted down to pack the camcorder back into its holder as she carried on undressing. I'm not stupid, you know, Seffi said wearily, taking off her jumper. None of you are wearing masks or disguising your voices. I could identify each and every one of you, but you don't care. Which means only one thing. You have no intention of letting me go, even if my father gives in to all your demands. My head shot up at that. We regarded each other as Seffi continued. One of you is going to kill me. It's just a question of when and who. She pulled her t-shirt over her head and threw it down on the floor. What now? She asked. You can put the rest of your clothes back on, I told her, picking up the t-shirt. As she pulled on her jumper, I tried not to stare, I really did. But her body had changed so much in the years we'd been apart. She had breasts now. Her purple lace bra just emphasized them rather than hid them. And her waist went in instead of straight down. And her stomach was flatter and her legs were longer and her face had lost its baby fat. And she was so very, very beautiful. I turned away as Seffi pushed her head through the neck of her jumper. I didn't want her to catch me staring. If your father does as he's told, you'll be okay. Okay? Like I'm okay now? Seffi scoffed. Come on, Callum. This is your chance to really take your revenge. Don't you want to get your own back for all those times you had to put up with me on the beach? And all those years pretending to be my friend, just praying for this moment. Shut up! Shut up! Ignore her, Callum, just ignore her. Put a straitjacket on your feelings. Don't let her see how much she's getting to you. What about that night we spent together in my room? She asked. Didn't that mean anything to you? You mean the couple of days before you murdered my father? I asked harshly. Your father died trying to escape. My father chose to die because he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison for something he didn't do. Seffi's gaze lowered briefly. She looked up again and said, I didn't murder your father, Callum. I didn't want him to die. You and your kind killed him, I told her, zipping up the camcorder case. So, you are going to kill me. But not you personally, I bet. Seffi's voice trembled. That's not your style, is it? You set me up so your friends could capture me. You're real good at letting others do your dirty work for you. I spun round at that. You wouldn't be the first dagger I've killed, not by a long shot. And I'd be easy to kill, wouldn't I? Seffi said quietly. Because I don't count. I'm nothing. Just a black dagger bitch. Just like you're a white blanker bastard. And now I was furiously angry, just like I'd wanted to be before I could do what I had to do next. I grabbed her left hand, and before she could pull away, I drew my knife across her index finger. Seffi gasped, tears instantly springing to her eyes. And my anger died with such a suddenness that I knew it hadn't been real to begin with. Manufactured to get me through the moment, the day, my life. "Sorry," I mumbled, wrapping her T-shirt around her finger. I concentrated on getting her blood onto the T-shirt. I didn't look at her. I couldn't. The white cotton of her shirt soaked up the blood like blotting paper. I unwrapped the shirt and dragged her still bleeding finger up and down it. The final proof for her father that we were deadly serious. The final proof that we were deadly. Seffi kept trying to pull her hand back, but I wouldn't let her. "I bet you enjoyed that," Seffi hissed at me. "No, I didn't," I snapped back, letting go of her wrist at last. Seffi put her finger into her mouth, wincing as the wound stung anew. She took her finger out of her mouth to look at it. It was still bleeding. The cut was deep. For both of us. Deeper than I had intended. A scratch would have been deeper than I intended. She went to put her finger back in her mouth, but I grabbed her hand again. She struggled, trying to pull her hand away. Maybe she thought I was going to cut her again. I put her finger in my mouth, and she was instantly still. I don't know how long we sat there watching each other. A second? An hour? Seffi moved first. She slowly pulled back her finger. "When you all decide you don't need me anymore," Seffi whispered, "I want you to do it. One favor, though. It's the last thing I'll ever ask you. Just make it quick, okay?" And she turned round and lay down on her side of the bed, her back towards me. I stared at her back, my fists clenched, reining myself in so tightly I thought my back would snap. Only when I could trust myself to stand without falling to the floor did I get up. I left the room, carefully locking the door behind me. I leaned against the door, my eyes closed. I had to do this. Make it through this, and I would. I turned to walk back to the living room, only to find my brother further down the corridor, watching my every move. "Yes?" I asked, annoyed. Everywhere I turned at the moment, Jude seemed to be watching me. "Give me the disc." I handed over the T-shirt and Seffi's hair before taking out the camcorder. I opened it up, took out the video disc and put it in its case before handing it over. Jude held it up carefully, before slipping it into his pocket. He looked long and hard at the T-shirt. When at last he looked at me, his grin was full of admiration and relief. "Now I know for sure whose side you're on. Well done, little brother. Pete and I are going to deliver all this, as well as our demands. Layla and Morgan will guard the house. Seffi Hadley is your responsibility. Understand?" I didn't answer. It was unheard of for the first and second in command to go off on a joint mission together like this. Why wasn't Jude going with Morgan, or Pete going with me? Why did Jude want to be with Pete? There was something going on here. "We should be back by morning," Jude continued. "If the general second in command arrives before we get back, make him welcome, after he's given you the password, which is Golden Man." Jude went to move past me. I stood back against the wall to let him go. Jude was my brother, but I trusted him less far than an elephant could jump. More than ever, I sensed the need to watch my back, my front, my sides, and every other part of me. If I wanted to keep them in one piece, that is.
Chapter 97. The door opened again. I didn't even bother turning around this time. I lay on my side, facing the wall. Rubbing my sore hand over my aching stomach, I fervently wished the pain away.
"Dinner!"
came Callum's rough voice. I ignored him and carried on rubbing my stomach, waiting for the sound of the door closing. It didn't come. Callum's footsteps echoed across the hard cement floor. I stopped rubbing my stomach at once, but I still didn't turn around. Callum put his hand on my shoulder and pulled me round to face him.
"Dinner!"
He thrust the plastic plate into my hand. I sat up, and after firing a lasering look in his direction, I threw the plate across the room. It hit the wall with a thud, and the plate fell first, followed by a brown, sticky mess trickling its way down the wall towards the floor.
"You shouldn't have done that."
I deliberately turned away from him and lay down again. Silence. But I wasn't going to turn around to see what he was doing. After a short while, I heard him cross the room and leave, locking the door behind him. He never forgot to lock the door.
Chapter 98. If I could just stop thinking for 5 seconds, then I could get some shut-eye. But it wasn't happening, and the sleeping bag seemed to twist in the opposite direction to whichever way I turned. I couldn't get Seffi's words out of my head. "One of you is going to kill me." But we didn't have to do that. Okay, so she'd seen us, but once her dad met our demands, we could be long gone. But even as I thought it, I knew I was just deluding myself. "One of you is going to kill me." "You look like you could use some company." Layla's voice above me was the last straw. I opened my eyes, giving up all pretense of trying to sleep. "Who's guarding the front?" "I came in for a loo break, if that's all right with you." I unzipped my bag and sat up. "No, it's not okay with me. You want to take a leak, do it in the woods, but don't leave the front of the cabin unmonitored." "I'm not a man," Layla protested. "I can't wee standing up." "That's no excuse." "Callum, you're mad as hell at something, but don't take it out on me." I pulled on my T-shirt. "I don't know what you're talking about." "You don't have to get dressed on my account," Layla said silkily, running her hands lightly over my chest. "Go and guard the front like you're supposed to," I told her. Layla stood up. "Suit yourself. Do you know, I think that's why I like you." At my puzzled look, she explained. "You're the only man I know who hasn't tried to get on my good side in 5 seconds flat." I smiled. "Nothing personal, Layla." "Thanks." She raised an eyebrow. "That makes it worse." I got to my feet as she left the room. Pulling on my boots, I decided to hunt down a beer and join Morgan out back. Without warning, there was a sudden commotion out front. I ran towards the front door when it burst open. For one split second, I thought we'd been rumbled, that the police had somehow tracked us down, but it wasn't the police. It was Layla and a stranger. He was as tall as me, with blonde hair tied back in a ponytail. He wore a dark polo shirt and expensive brown trousers tucked into fancy boots. His long, dark trench coat had the collar turned up and flapped open like a cloak or a cape. The peculiar thing was, the stranger had Layla in an arm lock, not the other way around. Morgan came running up behind me. "Who's in charge here?" the stranger asked. Morgan looked at me. I didn't take my eyes off the intruder. The stranger turned to me. "I see that you are. I believe you've been expecting me." "Let me go," Layla hissed, trying to twist away from the man who held her. The man pushed her forward hard. She only just kept her balance. She spun round, arms raised, ready to take him out. The man raised one hand. "I wouldn't if I were you," was all he said, but it was enough. A second or two later, Layla dropped her hands. "So, this is the famous stiletto unit, is it?" The man looked at each of us in turn. "So far, I'm not very impressed." "We've been expecting you, have we?" Morgan said. "That's right." "What's the password, then?" I asked. "You first," the man ordered. I regarded him. "I don't think so. You're the guest here, not us." I signalled to Morgan behind my back to get ready. We'd been caught on the hop, but there were three of us and only one of him.
How about...
Gold Man, said the stranger. Not even close. Morgan and I started forward. Then how about Golden Man? The stranger laughed. I regarded the man with undisguised venom.